You eat well, you work out, but did you know 99% of Americans are still mineral deficient? That's where Concentrace Daily Mineral Powder comes in. It's your daily foundation for better mood, natural energy, immune support, and nervous system balance. Formulated from nature and backed by science, it's a simple habit that makes a big impact. Because your body doesn't make minerals, and today's food and water don't supply enough, with Concentrace, you'll feel the difference. Go to TraceMinerals.com and start with minerals. Start with Concentrace.
I'm Emma Kenny. Welcome to Bang to Rights, the deep dive crime podcast, which takes you through some of the most heinous crimes the world has ever seen.
Let's get on with today's true crime case. Now, I appreciate that a lot of you are going to know about this case because it's been everywhere. Whenever there is a mass slaying, essentially, of life, rightfully so, it gets the attention that it requires in the media. And this series of horrific murders, the loss of life just so full of potential, is exampled in this case. So let's talk about the background. So first of all, the background of the murders themselves. So several students from the University of Idaho, they had basically chosen to rent a home off campus like so many students do. This was in the rural college town of Moscow, Idaho. They rented 1122 King Road. So Madison Mogan and Zana Knodel, they lived in a three-story home. That three-story home had six bedrooms, so it had two on each floor. Then there was Zana's boyfriend, a guy called Ethan Chapin. He would regularly stay over at the house, which you would imagine when you're in love with a partner and you're in college and you've got that independence. It's just such an exciting time. And if you're sharing space with somebody that you're in love with, it's just such a beautiful honeymoon period of your life. Also, Kaylee Goncalves, who was a friend of two of the girls who lived there. She'd recently moved out of the student house, but she did come back. So there was obviously no bad blood there. She just moved on in that respect. And then there were two other individuals who remained unharmed in this horrific attack. That was Dylan Mortensen and Bethany Funk. So before I kind of move on with the case itself, I just want to talk about the victims themselves. So Ethan Chapin, he was 20 years old. He was from Conway, Washington. Zana was 20. She was from Avondale in Arizona. She actually later lived in Post Falls, Idaho. Kaylee was 21. She came from Rathdrum, Idaho. And Madison was also 21 from Coeur d'Alene in Idaho. Bear in mind, there had not actually been a murder in this particular city since 2015. But that's all going to change on the evening of the 12th of November. So on the evening of November the 12th, 2022, Zana and Ethan attended an on-campus party at the nearby Sigma Chi fraternity. So like I said, these individuals are popular, charismatic, beautiful, fun young people living their lives, educating themselves, getting ready to go ahead and live pro-social experiences in the world around them, serving their families well because of the fact that they are doing their best to achieve. So that's the setup of the mindsets and the capabilities and capacities of these young people. And there they are just going about, having a fun time, going to parties. They end up returning back to the Moscow house around 1:45 a.m. Now that same evening, Madison and Kaylee, they'd gone to the Corner Club. It's basically a downtown sports bar, socializing, having fun. They arrived around 10 p.m. and they left around 1:30 a.m. in the morning. Now, there was a live streamed video on Twitch that many of you will have seen if you followed this case, and it took place by the Grub truck. That's a truck four streets down at the Friendship Square, which showed the pair at 1:41 p.m. chatting and smiling together, then got the food about 10 minutes later. They then got a taxi home. The trip was about a mile long. So it had been a fun all round night. We, as young people, in my own experience, used to go on what we call dubby runs at the end of the night. You've had fun, you go and grab yourself some dirty food and you get yourself back home. That's exactly what they were doing. So Madison and Kaylee, they arrived home about 1:56 a.m. So quite similar time frames for these individuals getting back home. Now, according to the two individuals who survived this situation, all four of the victims were home by 2 a.m. What we do know is that 7 unanswered phone calls were made from Kaylee's phone to her ex-boyfriend and also a fellow student. That was between 2:26 a.m. and 2:52 a.m. Now, we could read into that that maybe she was scared and she was calling him because of that. But often when you've had a bit to drink, when you're reminiscing in your head about an ex, it can lead you to contact them. So it could well just be that she had feelings for him or wanted to have a conversation with him about their relationship and their breaking up of that relationship. We don't know. What we do know is that a DoorDash order, which was labelled for Zana, that was delivered to the house at 4 a.m. Now, the 911 call that I suppose begins to unfold the horror of what I'm discussing today, that happened at 11:58 a.m. on the 13th of November 2022. And that 911 call was made requesting aid for an unconscious person within the house. So that was what was called in, that there was somebody unconscious in the house. So bear in mind, at that moment in time, the emergency services getting that kind of call. We're not talking about people who've been murdered. We're talking about somebody who might be unwell. But this is just the very precipice of what is going to involve a cavernous level of horror that's going to be discovered by the police. Now, that call was made by one of the roommates. When the police arrived, the first thing that they noticed was the door to the house was open. There wasn't any sign of forced entry. There wasn't any damage inside the home. It was, it seems, as if whatever had happened in the home hadn't caused any obvious damage. So nothing appeared to be missing. So it wasn't as if somebody had come in to try to steal things either. And then, of course, the police start to make the utterly horrific discoveries. They find four victims: Ethan, Zana, Madison, and Kaylee. Every single one of them had been brutalised, stabbed to death. They found them on the second and the third floors of the home. They found them mostly in bed. They hadn't been gagged. They hadn't been restrained. So they clearly were not expecting to be attacked, and for the most part, the victims didn't realise that their lives were coming to an end. I guess to some extent we can take a level of comfort from that, that the torture of their murders was not, shall we say, prolonged any longer than it had to be in their moments of dying. It isn't something that will bring their families comfort, but certainly when I think about their harrowing demise, no one would wish for that to be protracted. What was clearly evident when the investigators looked into the rooms where they'd lost their lives, the walls were just splattered with large amounts of blood. Zana and Ethan were found dead in Zana's room that was on the second floor. And then Madison and Kaylee, they were found in Madison's room together on the third floor. Police also found Kaylee's dog. She actually shared that dog with an ex-boyfriend, and the dog was alive. The dog was unharmed in the house. All four of those individuals were pronounced dead at noon on the 13th of November. When the detectives started to piece together when the killings occurred, they said that they believed that those killings occurred sometime between 4 a.m. and 4:25 a.m. The two surviving roommates, they were actually in the residence when these killings would have occurred. They were obviously there when the police arrived, and they were actually friends of the victims. So as far as they were concerned, this is going to be blindsiding. Somebody has been killed in the home that they share, and they were present during those attacks, allegedly. Now, the two surviving roommates who were actually in the residence when the police arrived were there, but also there were other friends of the victims present when the police arrived. Now, the reason for that is those roommates had allegedly called friends over to the home because they believed that on the second floor, there was a victim who was unconscious and not waking up. So for whatever reason, they hadn't ultimately recognised that something truly heinous had played out. They just thought they were dealing with people who were unconscious, which is kind of hard to wrap your head around when you consider the fact that there are a large amount of blood around. And I would imagine there is a level of understanding that would suggest that it was obvious that something far worse had taken place than somebody just being unconscious. So it does feel a little bit confusing as to what the emergency responders walked into, because like I said, they're imagining that somebody is unconscious and they've actually walked into a mass killing. Bear in mind, a mass killing is considered four people or more happening on one event. So when four or more people are killed in one event, we call it a mass killing. Before we start to go through the intricacies of the case, and of course, who is accused of these individuals' murders, I just want to take a moment to talk about the individuals who were killed. So Ethan Chapin, he was a freshman. He was a member of the Sigma Chi fraternity. He was from Conway, Washington. He was majoring in recreation, sport, and tourism management. He was actually one of a set of triplets. Those triplets were also university students at the University of Idaho. It is just breathtakingly devastating to imagine the loss of all of these young people, full stop. And every child is pertinently and obviously incalculably important to this world, and particularly of worth to the families who adore them. There is something for me that just feels gut-wrenching that we have a set of triplets. I think they're so rare. The psychological connection of being a triplet is evidenced in research to be incredibly strong because it's so unique. The fact that they have lost a part of who they are in such a direct way, because they are indeed a set of triplets, is just heart-wrenching and heartbreaking. And Ethan was said to just be an absolutely adorable individual, really popular, really likable, really bright, and was obviously going to go on and become an incredible human being in this world. Zana was a junior. She was at the University of Idaho majoring in marketing at the College of Business and Economics. She was actually a member of the Pi Beta Phi sorority. Again, comes from a lovely, loving family, adored, whip smart. Again, going to be an incredible human being if she'd been allowed that opportunity. And Zana is the one who put up a fierce fight. Apparently, she would have been aware that she was ultimately being killed, which is harrowing, but my God, she was a warrior. Apparently, she fought back and she grabbed the attacker's knife. In fact, she grabbed it so hard that she sustained really deep cuts to her fingers. In fact, her fingers were nearly severed. And even though that is harrowing, I think we all have to acknowledge that while she lost her fight in that moment, she fought like a warrior. She did not go down easy, and she has got the courage within her nature of somebody profoundly brave. And it's really challenging when somebody dies to think about those last moments, but equally it's the mindset behind those moments. She did not go down easily, and it's testament to her character and to her courage. Madison Morgan, she was a senior from Coeur d'Alene, Idaho. She was majoring in marketing. She was actually the sorority's director of PR and marketing, and she was best friends with fellow victim Kaylee Goncalves. And I think when it comes down to this young woman, the fact that she was the PR marketing director of the sorority, she was upwardly mobile. She was taking opportunities. She was going ahead and grabbing life by both hands. And the fact that she's already taking these roles just speaks so positively of who she was going to grow into, who she was going to become. And I found a really lovely quote by Kaylee Goncalves' father, who actually talked about the love that those girls had for one another. He said that they'd even been sharing a bed on the night of the murders. He said that both his daughter and his daughter's friend were just absolutely beautiful young women. He said they first met in sixth grade and they became literally inseparable. He said they just found each other, and every day they did homework together. They came to our house together. They shared everything. He said then they started to look at colleges. They even came here together. They eventually got into the same apartment together. And in the end, they died together in the same room, in the same bed. I know exactly what he's projecting in those words and sentiments. For him, it will be agonizingly grief-striking and devastating, and I'm sure his life will never be as full or beautiful as it would have been without his incredible daughter. But for him, the comfort of knowing that this girl that has been by his daughter's side, shared her in so many beautiful ways, that they died together. And I believe the way that he speaks suggests that he believes they're together still. And I indeed myself reflect those sentiments. It doesn't make it okay, but it brings a level of comfort to imagine that wherever they are in this big, beautiful beyond, they're probably holding hands and in bliss together. Kaylee, the young woman that I was just talking about, whose father was speaking, she was a senior. She was pursuing a general studies major. She was from Rathdrum, Idaho. She was a member of Alpha Phi Sorority, and she actually had planned to move to Austin, Texas in June. That was after her graduation would have been. But of course, we're not talking about her graduation, because that opportunity was stolen from her. That opportunity was stolen from every single one of those incredible young people that I've just mentioned. And it's difficult when we talk about these cases, because we always remember the names of the individuals who are considered the villains. And we very often forget the names of those individuals whose lives were snuffed out. I just wanted to head up before I talk about this case, the kind of human beings that we're talking about when discussing their loss of life. The community was absolutely devastated. As I said, these kind of crimes don't happen in this area. The evening of the 13th of November, the University of Idaho, in response to this mass killing, they cancelled all the classes for the following day. They also went ahead and scheduled a candlelight vigil. They actually held that on the university administration building lawn. That was on the 16th of November, just bringing people together, reminding people that the loss of life had been felt and heard, and that the value of these students who've been lost was paramount in their minds. That vigil ended up being postponed for 2 weeks, and the reason for that was the weather conditions. So in the end, the vigil was moved indoors to the Kibbe Dome, and that was held eventually on the evening of the 30th of November. Now, 3 days after the murders, Moscow police chief, a guy called James Fry, he actually came out and went on record saying, "We cannot say there is no threat to the community." Don't get me wrong, initially, he basically assured people that they didn't need to be worried. But at the end of the day, there is somebody who has clearly brutalized these individuals, slaughtered them, mostly in their sleep. But we know that one would have been aware and conscious when she was being killed. This is an individual who has the hallmarks of a serial killer. It's as simple as that. And bear in mind, when we think about crimes of passion, we don't think about individuals killing multiple people. We think about it being quite directive. When we consider familicide, it's related. So when people wipe out their families, we're talking about 4 people, 1 home, 2 floors, a protracted slaying. The idea that you can assure anyone, when that perpetrator has not been brought in, that they're safe and there isn't a threat, is ludicrous. It actually surprises me that initially they had assured anybody that the world around them was safe with this kind of killer being on the loose. And understandably, it was having real ramifications through the actual university. Students were terrified. If you can be murdered in your own home, in your sanctuary, where you'll only be safe, then nothing is safe and nowhere is safe. We have a bias of security, a belief that we structure in our minds that says once we close our door, once we close our windows, no one's coming in. It's such a shock to us when people violate that boundary. And for the most part, people don't violate the boundary. In fact, for the most part, even when it comes down to serial killers, often it is us leaving the door open that gives them permission to come in. Even they, to some degree, are opportunists. So when people breach these boundaries, it blindsides us and it makes us wake up to the fact that even when we think we're in the safest place in space, ultimately, there are predators who do not care for such belief systems and will breach such boundaries. Now, fall, that had actually been scheduled to begin on the 18th of November, and the classes were meant to resume on the 28th of November 2022. But understandably, these are bright students. These are individuals who are at university who've had their vulnerability just blown apart. Even though they've been assured by the police, don't worry, initially, they're not having it. So they started to leave the area really early. And it was actually noted that there was basically a Thanksgiving holiday exodus. Now, other residents did stay around, they did carry on, but quite a lot of precautions happened. Professors cancelled their classes because students were just really anxious. And as a result of that, it just changed the atmosphere, full stop, in that area. Now, from the get-go, I would say that the families of those individuals who were murdered were unhappy with certain things. So the parents of Kaylee and Ethan, they actually went ahead and criticised this really limited flow of information from the police and the university that they were receiving. I think that when you are the victim's family, you need transparency, you need to know exactly what is happening. And I've worked with families who have lost children to murder, not very often in my career, it's only happened a few times. And when I've worked with them in an indirect way, because I'll have been working with one of the family members as a young person and dealing with the issues that they're facing, and that's meant that I've actually had contact with families. What you tend to see is the more the police inform, the better the outcome for the families, because they feel, firstly, that work is being done to bring whoever is responsible to justice. And secondly, they feel like they're re-traumatised if things are heard through other sources that they feel should have directly been given to them. And that makes perfect sense. So for the families to feel in the dark about investigations can be deeply problematic. Equally, on a defence level of the police, we understand that certain elements of information are kept in the confidential environment of the authorities because they don't want things getting out, because that could actually cause issues with trying cases. So it is a balance to manage, but nonetheless, the family were unhappy. And there was a lot of speculation, there was a lot of rumours, there was a lot of misinformation, and a lot of that was being spread about the case. And there were a lot of these that were spread on TikTok, in particular by self-proclaimed psychics. Now, before anybody throws something at the screen and says, Emma, don't be dismissive about these psychics. You don't know what you're on about if you're pretending that these people can't potentially see the big beautiful beyond. Look, I get it. I'm the first person to say, I don't understand how I can text somebody here and then receive it in Australia in like a millisecond. I don't get it. I can't see how these words get there. I struggle with simple reality like that. So I don't question magic. I don't question possibility. I get that some people are super, super special in this world, both from an engineering, a scientific, and who knows, a spiritual level. There are different gifts we all have, but most are a bit rubbish, aren't they? Throwing it out there, most are a bit rubbish. I can self-proclaim I'm a psychic. And do you want to know something, guys? Little fact that you won't know about me. We have a guy called Derren Brown in the UK. He's done programs like Tricks of the Mind. He's excellent, actually. And I had a very lovely opportunity many years ago to go and pretend for him to be a psychic. And I was very good, because I'm pretty good at cold reading. And every single person who came to my fake psychic situation said I was the best psychic that they'd ever come across. And you might be able to find that somewhere on YouTube, maybe not. I would imagine it will be somewhere out there. But the point is, I am good at making people feel that I have a greater awareness of who they are because of certain things that they will give me, even in the most innocent of forms in communication, because that's all I've done my entire life, I've analysed. So I can tell you that even somebody like myself can seem, in certain situations, in environments, to have wider knowledge and to be quite convincing of that. So I genuinely believe that there are people out there that probably do have gifts, but most of them don't. And most of those going on TikTok and saying that they've got psychic information, if we were gonna do, I don't know, a little bit of a compilation of them all, a lot of them won't be telling the same story. So that in itself means it's problematic. But one of the issues that you'll have, of course, is the way that that impacts on people's attitudes around what's happening. And that can be very damaging for the family. Don't get me wrong, I do content like this, and I understand that sometimes that can be really upsetting for family members too, which is why I try to do it really diligently. At the end of the day, it's incredibly painful when you have your story out there and you might not necessarily always want it told. So I also acknowledged that, because I don't want to come across as some kind of person who doesn't see the irony in the fact that I also talk about these things. Now, in response to all of this flurry, shall we say, on social media, and all of this misinformation, I hate using that word because it's used in so many inappropriate ways these days, but you know, we're talking about genuine misinformation here. the Moscow Police Department actually started to criticize internet sleuths. They said that they were creating rampant online rumors and also disrupting investigations. I'm going to be honest though, as much as I think it's really problematic when people are making things up and just literally saying things that are completely untruthful, and I can absolutely see a problem with that, I also think it's unfair for the police to expect people to be silent on these matters. Listen, four unbelievable shining stars were slain. We want answers. I'm in the UK, I want answers. So it's normal for good human beings to think, I am going to do my best to make a difference to this case. And also, you can't have it both ways. The police want you to be interested in this case because we want the person who's guilty to be brought and put to justice at the highest level. And that comes down to keeping things alive. And the way we keep things alive, we talk about it. We jog people's memories. We have conversations. And actually, ultimately, that can bring in new information that's very pivotal in cases. So I do believe that it's really healthy for people to have these discussions, but just not to make up things that are completely untrue. In a 2nd of December press release, Moscow police captain, a guy called Roger Lehner, he said, there is speculation without factual backing, stoking community fears and spreading false facts. He said, tracking down rumours and quelling rumours about specific information and specific events that may not have happened is a huge distraction. We are not releasing specific details as we do not want to compromise the investigation. They also warned that people harassing or threatening those potentially involved with the case could face criminal charges. That all makes sense, but like I said, when it comes down to it, you can't control conversation, nor should you wish to. And actually, just because you're not listening in the direction of certain conversations doesn't mean that they don't have any worth or wealth. So that noted, let's carry on. Now, the investigations of the murders were conducted, of course, by the Moscow Police Department. They were also supported by the Idaho State Police and the Latah County Sheriff's Office. This is a big case. And in total, around 130 members of law enforcement from three agencies worked on the case. There is no doubt whatsoever they 100% from the get-go have wanted to bring in the person guilty for these horrendous crimes. The autopsies that were carried out showed that all four victims had been stabbed multiple times. They were performed in Spokane in Washington. The Latah County coroner said that most of the fatal wounds were in the chest and upper body. They could tell that they'd been stabbed with a really large knife. And at least one of the victims, as I've covered, had defensive stab wounds on her hands. They also said it was very likely that the victims had actually been attacked when they were sleeping in the beds and there was no sign of sexual assault. And that immediately brings us to consider the reasoning behind why somebody is going ahead and doing this. And I think at this point it's worth just analysing that. Because let's explore our expectation when it comes down to a series of horrific slayings that we're talking about right now. When we look at serial killers, and certainly when you think about BTK, for example, the first killings, four individuals, the Otero family, 1974, what we would automatically assume here is that this is somebody who has a real fantasy and fixation with killing. Understandably, that makes sense. So four people murdered, this is somebody who's built to a fever, to a crescendo to go ahead and do this. But when we look at comparables, our expectation would usually be a particular type of motivation. Certainly, sexual motivation is one of the big ones. Look at people like Ted Bundy, Israel Keyes, and add so many others to that particular description. There tends to be a motivation where they go, and there might be an individual who is the object of their attention, shall we say, and the others are victims of that circumstance. But there is no sign of sexual assault. Now, that does not mean for one minute that somebody cannot be sexually gratified and motivated and also, shall we say, enjoy the experience on a sexual level, even if they don't actually physically touch an individual in a sexual way. Because the way that we fantasize can also play into the way that we act. And certainly in crimes, that is possible. But it is quite surprising. When I think about comparables, I think about somebody like Joanna Dennehy, who was the individual who murdered three men in the UK, all thrill killings, and also tried to kill another two. She also used a knife. Now, for her, it was all about being notorious. She got a real thrill from sadism. So like I said, it is quite unusual to not see some level of sexual assault in these cases. And that says something about the mindset of the killer. So certainly power, control, I would say the omnipotence complex, a sense of feeling like God, and the fact that he's gone from room to room actually carrying out these murders again, suggests somebody who has at least the cool, calm, collected demeanour to carry out this kind of slaying consistently without that much fear or chaos, shall we say. That noted, obviously it's quite blitz orientated because he's violently stabbed these individuals and butchered them to some degree, but it is interesting to think about the mindset of this killer. Now, no weapon was recovered, but the police believe, as did the coroner, that a fixed blade knife had been used. Now, we've got roommates who survived. So the people who lived with the victims, the two surviving roommates, they talked about what happened the night of the 13th of November. They came home about 1 a.m. Now, the original reports stated that both of the surviving roommates were actually in the beds on the ground floor at the time of the killings. And of course, they weren't attacked. They weren't held hostage. Neither of them, according to those original reports, actually woke up during the murders. Now, we know that one person fought back during the killings. The other three allegedly were killed in their sleep. They could have had alcohol in their system, so they were indeed asleep and weren't aware of what was playing out. But one person, it sounds like, certainly would have made some kind of noise. But that doesn't mean that you're absolutely going to hear that somebody's in distress and you're going to get woken up by that. However, that report is inconsistent with the probable cause affidavit, because in that case, it said that one roommate said that she was sleeping on the second floor. So that's the same as Zana and Ethan. And she said that she was actually woken up by what she thought was Kaylee and her dog. She then said that she thought she heard somebody that she believed was Kaylee saying something to the effect of, "There's someone here." Now, investigators actually believe that was more likely to have been said by Zana, because there was a forensic download that they did on her phone, and that showed at 4:12 a.m. she was on TikTok. Also, security cameras that were near the home, they actually picked up the sound of whimpering. Also, they picked up a loud thud and also a dog barking lots of times. That began around 4:17 a.m. Now, whatever was going on for that roommate, it meant that she was alerted to a degree where she did go ahead and open her door twice. That was in a relatively short span of time. Now, the second time, she heard what she said sounded like crying coming from Zana's room, and also a male voice saying, "It's okay, I'm going to help you." I feel that there is a missed opportunity there, genuinely. Please acknowledge, as I'm sure you already do, I'm not blaming this roommate. It is not something I can pretend I understand, to be in a situation where you're afraid that something bad is playing out, or you're confused about what might be going on, and so the consequence is you don't actually check. But if I heard somebody that could be a friend of mine crying, and I heard a male voice say, "It's okay, I'm going to help you," I'd immediately think, what the hell is going on? I think to myself, Jesus, what's happening here? Why is there a guy saying he's going to help my friend? What the hell has happened to my friend? And I do feel that's a missed opportunity. Now, that roommate said that she ended up opening the door a third time. And at that point, she said that she saw a man dressed in black clothing with a mask that covered the mouth and nose walking towards her. She said that he was around 5'10", apparently wasn't very muscular. He was apparently athletically built. He had bushy eyebrows. But she said that she didn't actually recognise him. Apparently he walked past her, then he used a sliding glass door to exit the property. Now, I don't know about you guys. Again, I'm not trying to blame this individual for anything, right? I'm not. I'm just saying, I find this really atypical. Because I tell you what, if some guy had walked past me wearing a ski mask, I didn't know who the hell he was, I would be screaming. If I wasn't screaming, I'd be ringing 911 and saying, "My God, please get here. There's been an invader in my property. He was wearing a mask." I don't need to know anything other than this guy is wearing a mask and he's in my home to know that that's not normal. That's bizarre. He's not there for good purposes. We're not having a party. This isn't some kind of masked event. There is somebody in your home wearing black who has his face covered, and there's no reason for that. That would mean there was an intruder in the house. But apparently this roommate said that she just stood still in what she termed frozen shock phase and then locked herself in the room. I really struggle to understand why she waited hours and hours and hours to call the police. It just doesn't make sense. I've tried to figure this out, guys. I really have. I've gone through this timeline again and again to figure out whether I've got something wrong, but I haven't. This is the right way that things transpired. I cannot compute, particularly if you're saying that you also thought that somebody was saying that they were in trouble or distress and that somebody was going to help them. And then you've seen somebody walking out of your house who was not meant to be there and you don't call the police immediately. No matter what level of shock you're in, surely just to call the police would make sense because at least you'd feel like there was a level of protection. I mean, people leave comments and let me know if you disagree with that, but shock, I understand very, very well. I appreciate that people go numb. It can make you feel like you're completely unable to act. I get it. But in this kind of situation, I find it very unusual. We get to the 19th of November, 2022. At this point, the police are just requesting the public to provide any videos of the house that had been recorded on the night of the killings. Because of course, these days, people have got Ring doorbells, they've got video surveillance. And even if you haven't particularly got it on your home, other people do. Just think about the Chris Watts case. That's so interesting because his neighbor from the get-go just knew after watching the video surveillance of Chris taking what we know now with the body of his wife into the vehicle. He had it all down, didn't he? And that's what we know. So they go off and they ask, can we please get any information, any CCTV that you've got? A phone tip line and an email was established for people to submit this potential evidence to the police. And as of the 5th of December, it was incredible, the response. And this is what I love about human beings. I know that it's really difficult for the police when they get thousands of leads because they have to investigate those leads. And that's really difficult on a workforce level. But it also speaks to you of the care and compassion of the average human being. The fact that they had over 2,600 emails and 2,700 phone calls. They also had 1,000 digital media submissions. That community were all involved in wanting to bring this person to justice ASAP, and they went above and beyond to do so. We get to the 24th of December. Police stated that they had received at least 15,000 tips regarding the case. Aren't the community amazing? Doesn't that just speak volumes about how important those young people were? We get to the 23rd of November. The Moscow police chief said that authorities had received a number of tips, and those tips had eventuated in suggesting that Kaylee had a stalker. Now, the police were actually unable to verify this, but obviously there has been some conversation about maybe some unwanted attentions. I would imagine that if they download phone information for Kaylee, they'll be able to see whether there've been any conversations about this. But it is notable that certain individuals have put forward a theory that there was somebody who was giving her some kind of unwanted attention. Like I said, that hadn't been verified. What we do know is on the 15th of December, the police said that they were searching records of approximately 22,000 fifth generation Hyundais because this was apparently a vehicle that they were interested in. Now, it was a Hyundai Elantras that had been made between 2011 and 2013 that they were interested in. And that is a big gig, isn't it, to have to go through all of those records. The reason for this is a camera in the area that the murders took place had actually captured a video of a white, or at least a light coloured Elantra around the time of the murders. Also, investigators had noticed that car did make multiple passes along the same route near the residence. And another surveillance video actually showed an Elantra passing the victim's house three times. That began at 3:29 a.m. At 4:04 a.m., the Elantra returned to the home for a fourth time. And at 4:20 a.m., the car was actually seen speeding away from the Moscow area. So understandably, why is a car going around and around? I suppose one could say, well, people get lost. Not everyone is like me, stuck to their Apple Maps or their Waze app, you know. Some of us still just drive around and allow ourselves to get a little bit lost, and we can end up in the same place again and again and again. But the fact that these murders have taken place, it's definitely pricked the investigators' conscience. They're concerned about why this car has been there multiple times. And that brings us on to Brian Koberger. So before we talk about Brian Koberger and how he's ended up being implicated in these horrific murders, let's just talk about the man, who he is. So I suppose the investigation into Brian Koberger begins because of the fact that there's a white Elantra that he owns. He's 28 years old at the time that this begins. So Brian Christopher Koberger was actually somebody who was in a university town in Pullman, Washington, and he's got a car that fits the description, potentially, of the individual who's been seen driving around. Now, when we look at him, he's quite an intriguing character, I would say. He was born on the 21st of November, 1994. He was born in Albrightsville in Pennsylvania. He graduated from Pleasant Valley High School in 2013. Friends who knew him said he was an interesting character, I would say. So Sarah Healy, she actually knew Koberger when they were both young. She said that he was relatively quiet. He was quite friendly to her. And that one of the things that he struggled with was his weight, and he got bullied over his weight. And for those people who have been larger at school, you run the gauntlet. Honestly, I look back at my own experiences in school, and bear in mind, I never got bullied at all. Girls at my school were actually super friendly. I'm sure that certain sniping went on, but for the most part, I was incredibly lucky. But I still felt like I ran the gauntlet every day. My hair alone was such a problem that it made going to school was an issue. I genuinely struggled massively, particularly at high school. Now, if I had been bullied by people, if I had been made to feel terrible about my weight, for example, it would have been harrowing. So even though we sometimes flippantly say, oh, this person was bullied about their weight, as if it's just par for the course, this kind of stuff happens, it is horrible. And it can destabilize anybody, make them feel isolated, make them feel abandoned, make them feel resentful, make them feel rageful, because you lose a sense of control over your environment. And it can do one thing, which is make you feel very helpless and vulnerable. And that can play out in relationships down the line. One of the reasons why we work with people who've been bullied to make them, quote, bully-proof, is because you can't change the bullies a lot of the time. The bullies are always going to be bullies, whether they're 20 or 60 or 12. What you can do is change the mindset of the individual being bullied. And it's sad that we have to do that, because you shouldn't have to change because other people are nasty, but we also want you to have a better life. But the impact can be horrific. Equally, we have seen in certain cases that people who are bullied can become quite sadistic as they get older, because they don't want to be made to feel that level of helpless again. So he gets bullied by his peers over his weight. That would be devastating for him. And Sarah Healy said it was really upsetting. He was apparently mostly bullied by females, so that could cause a big thread of distrust and resentment towards women. Apparently he was quite large. He was very quiet. He was very introverted. He was very into his books. But she said, you know, on reflection, he was really sweet and really quiet. So for her, the fact that he's being introduced into this case as a potential suspect is shocking. Others have a slightly different perspective. They said that he was somebody who actually could be quite manipulative and quite sadistic. So Casey Arndt, she was actually 2 years older than him in high school. She said that she didn't remember him being bullied. She said that he was indeed nice to her, as was validated by the other individual who I've just talked about, but that he bullied her brother. So she said, I know that he had anger issues and he would have outbursts and stuff. I never saw them face to face. My brother said, though, that when Brian would get angry with him, he would kind of gaslight him and get physically aggressive. So certainly we've got conflicting details about how he was at school, but we've all been in situations where we have relationships with individuals that we get on really well with and they're amazing, and then we find out some nasty stuff about them from other people's perspectives. So again, it can all be true. Brian Koberger could well have been bullied horrendously. He could also be a really sweet, nice person at school. And he could also be a bit of an arse with people that were close to him. In this case, gaslighting and getting physically aggressive with somebody that he disagrees with. That could all be true. But I suppose what is most notable is there is nothing outstandingly dreadful about him in school that makes everybody nod their head and go, well, Everybody saw that coming, that we could see with other killers of a level and gravity that we're discussing in this case. Now, one of the things that I have found is he apparently suffered from a condition in a forum online thing called Tapper Talk. In 2011, he actually wrote about having a condition called visual snow. And he wrote, "It's as if the ringing in my ears and the fuzz in my vision is simply all of the demons in my head mocking me." Now, visual snow syndrome is basically a little known neurological disorder. Scientists first recognized it in 1995. Some of you will actually know this and have this and understand it when I talk about it. If you happen to have this condition, it means that you're continuously seeing these tiny slow like flecks in your vision. It's like the world is in front of them, but they're seeing it through a badly tuned old TV set. And often the dots are like black and white. They can sometimes be transparent. And it remains like that even when they close their eyes. So that can be really debilitating. It can mean that people have problems learning. Studies also show that there's a high incidence of depression, anxiety, and poor sleep as side effects. It affects around 2% of the world population. And it's really rare. And the problem with that is that because it's rare, there isn't a lot of money and funding and researching it. So people are only just starting to really get to grips with what the condition is like. And that was apparently something that he struggled with. And I guess that might also give us an insight into some of his mental health issues that I believe that he has been struggling with in the past. Even though I have extensively researched this case, I will tell you that I have some ideas that I'm just going to throw in for good measure. You can listen to them or you can throw them out equally, whatever you wish to do with them. Now, when I looked at his family history, they're nice. That's why I'd say his family are lovely. His parents were both employees of the Pleasant Valley School District and they were there for a very long time. So we're talking about a mum and a dad who gave him a very stable foundation. They're a very loving family. Michael, his father, was a maintenance worker for the school district and he was there from 2006 to 2019. I think anybody who does 13 years in the same position is somebody who gets on well with people, who knows how to professionally toe the line, who does a good job. And his wife, so the mother of the alleged perpetrator, Mary Ann Koberger, she was employed again by the Pleasant.
Prescription products require completion of an online medication consultation with an independent healthcare provider through the LifeMD platform and are only available if prescribed. Subscription required. Individual results may vary. Additional restrictions apply at LifeMD.com. Read all warnings before using GLP-1s. Side effects may include a risk of thyroid C-cell tumors. Do not use GLP-1s if you or your family have a history of thyroid cancer.
Confused on where to start with weight loss medication? See the lowest prices available with or without insurance for Wegovy, Zepbound, and more at TryLifeMD.com. 95% of LifeMD patients said starting their weight loss journey was simple. Listen to Tara's story after losing 42 pounds.
You just take your shot. It doesn't feel like you're on a diet. What I wasn't expecting it to do was to shut off the food noise. I had gone from 237 to 195. This was life-altering, and if I can do it, I feel like anybody can do it.
Get your free insurance benefits check in minutes right now at TryLifeMD.com. Nearly 96% of patients said they would recommend the LifeMD program to anyone who wants to lose weight. Get started right now at TryLifeMD.com. That's TryLifeMD.com.
If you're shopping while working, eating, or even listening to this podcast, then you know and love the thrill of a deal. But are you getting the deal and cash back? Rakuten shoppers do. They get the brands they love, savings, and cash back. And you can get it too. Start getting cash back at your favorite stores like Target, Nike, and Instacart. Stack sales on top of cash back and feel what it's like to know you're maximizing the savings. It's easy to use and you can get your cash back sent to you through PayPal or check. The idea is simple. Stores pay Rakuten for sending them shoppers and Rakuten shares the money with you as cash back. Download the free Rakuten app or go to Rakuten.com to start saving today. It's the most rewarding way to shop. That's Rakuten, Rakuten.com.
Pleasant Valley School District until 2020, and she actually worked as a paraprofessional assisting special needs students. So again, she worked very hard. She's clearly got a compassionate nature. She's chosen to work with people with special needs. And he also has two sisters, Amanda and Melissa. Again, apparently super lovely human beings. I would say that if you're looking for the fracture in the family, not the black sheep altogether, but the one who caused the issues, it was Brian Koberger, without a doubt. The other children don't seem to have caused any issues for the parents, particularly growing up, but Koberger certainly did. In fact, in 2014, he was arrested for stealing from his own sister. And again, this is why I think that the parents are really amazing. And you'll figure that out in a moment when I tell you about how this played out. But I genuinely think that they had strong boundaries in the family and they knew right from wrong and were bringing him up with that mindset. It's worth noting Koberger did struggle with drug addiction. And even by the age of 19, when he's arrested because he steals from his own sister, apparently he still had an issue with heroin. And heroin is an incredibly addictive substance and deeply problematic across the board, physically, psychologically, and socially and familiarly because of the way it impacts on you. Now, Pennsylvania's publicly available court records actually don't show any signs of the case that I'm talking about with him being arrested. But the reason for that, it was reportedly expunged under a program for first-time offenders. So basically, they wrote off the record. But what happened was that his dad, Michael, had actually told the police that Brian Koberger had stolen his sister's iPhone. So he had gone ahead and turned him in to the police. So it's very clear that the family was strict with their boundaries. And when Koberger did what he did to his sister, the family were not having any of it. Now, eventually, it's clear he got his life together. He lost a lot of weight. He picked up boxing. He picked up running. This is all before going to college. So at this point, everything is clearly looking up. He's kicked his addiction. He's still got the support of his family. He's going to go and do some studying. Everything bodes well. He ends up going and attending Northampton Community College's campus in Tannersville. And in 2018, he gets an associate degree in psychology. Now, one of his classmates said that he was a little bit problematic in class. They used the phrase contrarian. Now, I think that it's really helpful with respect to have people with contrarian viewpoints. Don't get me wrong. Me and my son, who's my eldest son, often have these debates and we will refer to one another as being purposefully contrarian. And what we're actually saying is, you're annoying me because you're just not agreeing with my point of view. But it's really healthy, isn't it, to have people who play devil's advocate. It can be, though, just a little bit on the frustrating side. I have, shall we say, in my debating career over the years, been on television with somebody who I know doesn't really have the view that they're saying on TV. They've just wanted to get on for talking points because no one in the right mind would take their position unless they were going to get 500 quid and a night in a hotel. Honestly, I'm telling you the truth because I know those people who've come on and I know that they don't really think that way. I can't do that on the whole. I just say what I think and feel. And when people always take the contrarian point of view, if you are in a class with them, it can be overwhelmingly boring, because you know that they're doing it just to provoke a response. And I think where Koberger is concerned, this is something that's prevalent in his personality. I think that he likes to provoke reactions from people and they are not always positive. I'm not sure that when other people give him obvious signs and symbols that he's just being a bit annoying, that that goes in and resonates with him. I just think there is something about his nature that he just doesn't connect the dots. And so as opposed to people enjoying the debate, they just see him as someone who's ultimately saying things for the reason that he wants to provoke other people's reactions. And that can be really annoying. He also was said to get into heated arguments with other students. And again, that is completely acceptable when we're debating. It can be very passionate, but I feel that ultimately others did not think he was being authentic to what he believed. Also, it's noted that he used to have particular disagreements more with women. And in fact, on one occasion, there was a female doctoral student who actually stormed out of the classroom. She accused Koberger of mansplaining. It's quite funny to me, that term, mansplaining. It's a very modern slur, isn't it? When a guy's got a view and he says it to you and you don't like it and you think he's simplifying something and you don't need to have that simplifying, you're like, you're mansplaining. I genuinely think that every woman listening to this will think, well, yeah, well, many times we with men womansplain. Do you know, at the end of the day, let's be clear that no one's perfect and people ultimately will explain things to us that we find patronizing. It not necessarily has any attention or connection to our gender. But nonetheless, this is a new term and it's quite an effective way of shutting a man down, isn't it? And I don't necessarily think that's good for discourse between genders per se, but hey, it obviously offended her. But again, I think that speaks to his mindset and personality where he just likes to push the boundaries. And that can be really upsetting for people when we feel like it's not necessary. Now, after graduating, he ends up working as a security guard for the Pleasant Valley School District. That's the same district that his father previously worked for and his mother. His obviously been in a situation where his mother and father having some work with that organisation and area has meant that he's gone in. We all know how that works, you know. You hear about a job, you say my son's looking for one, and he was given that opportunity. He receives a BA in 2020 and he gets an MA in 2022, so he's bright. That was in criminal justice and that was from DeSales University in Center Valley, Pennsylvania. Now, I would say that those ideas about him growing up having certain problems with his behaviour, the way that he bullied certain people, albeit being bullied as well, and the contrarian perspective that he takes is something that is endemic within his personality because he's not necessarily always towing the line as he should, and it does cause him some issues. So in summer 2022, he moved to Washington State. And the reason for this is he's going to pursue a PhD at Washington State University in Pullman. Now, anybody who has gone ahead and pursued a PhD, even just getting accepted onto a PhD course, it means you're bright. It means you're academically very clever. PhDs are unbelievably challenging. They take a great deal of work and they are hardcore to get through. And it takes somebody with real academic steel and determination with respect to go ahead and do that. So again, he's succeeded academically and this should be a new opportunity for him to continue with that path. Now, that campus of Washington State University is less than 8 miles west of Moscow, where these killings took place. So in November 2022, he's a doctoral student in criminology and he'd actually completed his first semester there 9 days before ultimately he would be arrested for allegedly carrying out these killings. Now, there's been a lot of speculation about the fact that this guy was doing criminology and the fact that he was studying at a high level. Bear in mind though, he'd only completed his first semester there. So we're not talking about somebody who's succeeded in this arena and area. We're not talking about somebody who's effectively schooled in criminology. Yes, he's done his psychology degree before, but certainly I've heard information about him being really forensically advanced because of his position, and that is just not going to be true. I would be as advanced if I read a book on criminology at this point as he was doing that first semester. So I think it's important to remember that even though he's painted as a master villain in some areas when looking at this case, that does not speak volumes when we actually look at the evidence that we've got. He'd just literally done his first semester. And we all know your first semester in university, whatever course you're doing, is rife with getting to know the area, creating relationships, getting yourself into a rhythm. You're not really taking that much in at that moment in time. But equally, is it that he's interested in criminology because there is a malevolent nature within him and he likes the idea of understanding the criminal mind more because he relates to it? Now, Koberger at this point had been teaching in Washington State University as an assistant. So he was a teaching assistant, he's helping out. But less than 2 weeks before the murders, faculty members had actually met with him because they were really concerned about his behaviour and they were concerned about his conduct. And in fact, on the 19th of December, he was fired. And that decision was based on unsatisfactory performance, and this included his failure to meet the norms of professional behaviour in his interactions with the faculty. So to some degree, we can say, well, what is it about this man's personality that people don't connect with? It's not the only person who's saying he struggles. But again, just for balance, I have worked in environments where if you are somebody that doesn't necessarily communicate in a way that is in line with others, it's problematic to the cohesion of the group, and often that results in that person being removed. Even if their work was okay, it's not just about your work being acceptable, it's about you fitting and connecting, acting in a manner that's approachable for others to come to you with, and also in ways where you bond with other members of staff so it doesn't feel awkward. And if we think about those contrarian points of view, the arguments that he has, particularly with women, I can imagine that he's not the easiest person to say, do A, B, or C. I think he has a superior mindset in his own mind about his capabilities and capacity, and therefore he feels that he knows the right way, even ultimately if it's not directed by his seniors and managers. And in fact, he's probably the type of person who will go and do what he wants as opposed to do what he's informed to do. And that is going to lead to issues. And in this case, ultimately, it means that he loses his job. That does not suggest that he's then going to become a murderer. Just because he's awkward, contrarian, problematic in the way he acts, lots of people lose jobs and then go on to lead very good lives. Now, there is another interesting thing that I found out about him before the murders. So this is a few months before those four lovely young people were murdered. He was actually warned about the interactions he was having with women. He was going to a bar in Bethlehem, Pennsylvania, and his behaviour just stuck out to the girls there. So Jordan Sarulnek, he was the owner of Sirens Brewing Company, he said that the bar staff actually scan IDs of all the patrons, which is amazing, because what they do then is they actually add notes to the internal system. So if they have somebody who's violent, aggressive, problematic, disrespectful, if they drink too much and then get in the car and drive, they can add information to that internal system, which is fabulous because it protects the staff. And staff actually put in there, hey, this guy makes creepy comments. Keep an eye on him. Also, he'll have two or three beers and just get a little too comfortable. And this particular manager said one of the things that he even noted about Koberger was that firstly, he was alone. So he came in by himself. He was drinking by himself. And he sat there, not communicating with people, but just more observing and watching other people. And when he did engage in conversation, he'd ask the staff or the customers where they lived and who they were at the bar with. He also said that if women were actually responsive to that, if they were interested in talking to him, he got upset with them. In fact, he called a staff member a bitch when she wouldn't answer his questions. Now, again, in the backdrop of what we potentially know he has done, that reflectively seems sinister. But if we analyse the information just blankly, how many times do those kind of conversations occur? All the time. If I'm having a conversation with somebody, and I used to be a bar girl, I've also been a waitress, loved that job, absolutely loved it. I think serving food is something that I'm just genuinely aligned with because I love eating and I love cooking. So it was perfect marriage for me. But I do remember very regularly, particularly when I was running the bar, that men would speak to me. And they would often ask me where I came from, what I was doing, did I have a boyfriend? And they weren't even interested in me in that way. It was just, we were finding things out. Now, I'm one of those people that you can ask me as many questions as you like. I am just an open book. I do not take offense to anybody over anything on the whole. You can say whatever you like, even if it's offensive to everybody else, because I've spent my life working in analysis and I know that human beings are a range of thoughts and feelings, and one specific comment does not make them a terrible human being. I take the whole, and I like to have conversations that are challenging. So I've always been one of those people that I would not necessarily notice those as being boundary problematic. But I also know loads of women in particular who have really struggled with things that have happened to them in the past. And when somebody is trying to talk to you about where you live, whether you've got a boyfriend, it feels really intrusive. And I think that those notes are relating to the fact that there was just something about the way that he had those conversations that differed to other patrons, because clearly they will have that every day of the week where guys are hitting on them or talking to them or asking them intimate questions about their life. But often the way that that person is doing it just feels natural and doesn't feel creepy. I think that Koberger was coming across creepy, and arguably that's why those notes were added. But in his defense, I can also see why ultimately these conversations happen every day of the week and wouldn't necessarily evoke such a reaction. When it comes down to calling a staff member a bitch when she wouldn't answer his questions, that's completely inappropriate. I can also say that some people will think that that's quite funny to use that term because she's not forthcoming with the information. And bitch is a word that is overused in our society, both on a comedy level and interaction level. And it could just be, it's a turn of phrase that he uses because he thinks it's acceptable to do. I'm not saying it is. I'm just trying to play devil's advocate, like he does apparently as a contrarian, in describing how those notes can seem cold when read and very incriminating, but if you analyse them a little bit further, maybe not quite as sinister as we could portray. Now, the investigators initially began to investigate Koberger because of his car, that white Elantra. And one of the things that had happened is his father had come over to Koberger to drive it back to his home in the Pocono Mountains of Pennsylvania. This was for the holidays. Koberger's Elantra was actually made in a later year than the original police description. And that is important to note. If we are exploring the possibility that eyewitnesses have seen a vehicle and that those police have been looking for a vehicle that is a different date that the vehicle that he has is connected to, well, that has to suggests that there is a potential that it isn't his car that they're looking for. I'm just saying that because I'm going to go into why people think he's guilty, but I also think it's very important with circumstantial evidence to look at the description. So his Elantra is not the year that they were meant to be looking for, but they've extended that, expanded that, and now they're looking at his car. He ends up getting pulled over twice within a 5-mile radius by Indiana State Police. This is on Interstate 70 outside Greenfield, Indiana. The reason they pulled him over was because allegedly he was tailgating, and the fact that he's pulled over twice demonstrates that, I don't know, Mr. Koberger, listen, learn. Maybe that stuff about you being a bit of a contrarian is true, because ultimately, if you've just been told by a police officer, and he did it very respectfully, the police officer who pulled him over, you're tailgating, don't do it. And then like 5 miles later, you're still doing it. It speaks of somebody who listens, but doesn't necessarily hear or doesn't necessarily believe that the rules apply to them. So his car is now being flagged up because, like I said, he's acting in a problematic manner whilst he's driving it. And he's with his dad, and his dad is obviously there, a bit worried about what's playing out and trying to explain things, talking about where they're going, why they're going home for the holidays. And also people were intrigued as to know why his father was with him. But it seems like his father needed to be with him to get him home, because I would ultimately say psychologically the family have some concerns about Koberger driving by himself. And ultimately, even it could be that Koberger wants his father with him because it's a long journey. Now, the investigators go ahead and get phone data because they want to check out where Koberger had been the night of the murders. And when they get that data, it shows that Koberger's phone stopped connecting to the network around 2:47 a.m. That was in Pullman on the 13th of November. Now it reconnects around 4:48 a.m. This is near Blaine, Idaho, and it's near the US Highway 95 south of Moscow. Police are also able to show that his phone utilised a cell tower near the victim's home around 9 a.m. on the 13th of November. Now, this is about 5 hours after the murders. Police were also able to then obtain further data, and that indicated that Koberger's phone pinged from the cell phone tower nearest the victim's residence at least 12 times between June 2022 and the 13th of November 2022. Now, I don't feel 12 times between June 2022 and November 2022 is a lot of times. I mean, he doesn't live too far away. At the end of the day, it would be completely feasible that you could have somebody's cell phone pinging a tower local to a victim many times over the months. 12 times ultimately doesn't sound like we've got some kind of stalking case going on. We've got something that's really fixated going on. We've not got somebody who's just there all the time. But nonetheless, I suppose for the police, this is another, shall we say, nail in the coffin. Koberger also followed the Instagram accounts of Madison, Kaylee, and Zana, but none of the victims followed him back. Now, what I would say about Madison, Kaylee, and Zana is they are all gorgeous. So again, we are living in a social media world where people like to follow other people and don't necessarily get follows back. We all know that. We all know the ratio situation where you have loads of followers and you only follow a few people. That's how social media works. It's not a follow for follow situation. And when you are attractive girls, often you will have lots of people who follow you that you have no idea of. It's as simple as that. None of them followed him back, so they weren't encouraging any kind of communication. There wasn't a relationship between them. But 2 weeks before they were killed, Koberger did actually send a series of messages to one of the victims. He actually sent a hello type message in late October. He didn't get a reply or response to that. And he did go ahead and send several more, but they weren't aggressive. They weren't nasty. They weren't escalating. They weren't suggestive that he was getting frustrated with that person. The authorities said that those messages probably weren't even seen by the victim because they went into the message request folder. But what they did say was there's no indication that he was getting frustrated with her lack of response, but he was definitely persistent. But again, it's clear that Koberger maybe has an issue with boundaries and doesn't really read women very well. So somebody ignoring him probably doesn't bother him that badly. Also, it was said that he had more than one picture of one of the female victims on his phone. It's unclear as to whether he took it or whether it was pulled from social media. Again, that is not atypical. It's another reason why I think that people don't realise that when you put something out on social media, anybody can grab hold of that information and have a picture of you on their phone. So we appreciate that that, again, is not something that suggests that this guy is obsessed with anybody. They found one picture, not 1,000 pictures. At least that's what we know at this point. Now, he also allegedly visited the Mad Greek restaurant in Moscow. Now, this is where both Madison and Zana work as servers, and that was in the weeks before the murders. So he has pictures of one of the people that have died. He also has sent messages to one of the victims, and he's also visited the actual place that two of them work in the weeks before the murders. Now, according to a former employee, he came in at least twice to buy vegan pizza. It's unknown whether either of the female victims interacted with Koberger. I think that it is interesting that he was literally a devout vegan, which is really ironic when you consider these charges. Again, you can be a vegan and a serial killer. Your relationship to animals versus your relationship to people are completely different, but he was quite devout. So you would envisage that life was incalculably important to him, and that's life across the board, whether you are a human being or a mouse, because that's how we animal lovers and we people who choose not to eat animal products feel about life. It's about not wanting to do harm to anybody or anything, whether that's a fly or whether it is indeed a dolphin or a whale, etc. We just have a no killing mindset. It's as simple as that. And that is something that I find quite hard to navigate when I think about Koberger as a human being. This vegan going and slaughtering, and that's the only word that can be aptly used to describe these murders. It just feels a juxtaposition. But like I said, the minds of killers are atypical to the minds of well-adjusted human beings. So it can't be thrown out as, oh, he's vegan, therefore he would not have gone ahead and carried out these horrendous killings. Particularly, shall we say, is, as is being painted in some areas, he has a resentment towards females, maybe because of the way he was treated at school. But it's worth noting, and he was apparently somebody who was so connected to veganism that he literally would not let you cook anything that had had meat in it if he was being served a dish from it. He would not let you do that. You had to have separate items, full stop. He didn't want anything that had contained any traces potentially or had any history with cooking meat. I suppose we can also then bring in an idea that he has quite an obsessive mindset and that there is a obsessiveness to the way that he acts, full stop. And that's going to be something that we explore a little bit more in this video from my understanding of this person and personality that he has. So far, I suppose what we definitely have is a level of circumstantial evidence about Koberger and the potential of him being involved in this crime. So let's now talk about the physical evidence. The police had managed to obtain 3 unidentified male DNA samples from the crime scene. Now, That wouldn't be unusual in a house frequented by lots of different students, particularly a house where they have a lot of fun and they have a lot of friends. You would expect that there will be different DNA samples collected from that crime scene because people are going to be regularly going there and hanging out. Now, this actually included, though, DNA found on a tan leather knife sheath that was found on Madison's bed. So, clearly, if you find a knife sheath on somebody's bed, that is incriminating because you're going to imagine that that's got to be connected to the actual killing. Also, investigators managed to recover trash, and they did that from outside of the Koberger family home in Pennsylvania. They wanted to find DNA, whether they could connect, therefore, the DNA with that they turned up from the actual victim's home. They then used a public genealogy database, and they were able, during doing that, to identify a partial match to an individual related to Koberger. I think that when people talk about that, you instantly go, well, slam dunk case, 100% guilty. They've got a match of DNA. But anybody like me who's done something like MyHeritage and found out about their connections with family members, you know that a partial DNA match can match a ton of people, genuinely a ton of people. So I'm not convinced by that, by the way. I'm just going to be really clear. I am not convinced about a partial match when it comes down to connecting him directly to the crime. They said that the DNA recovered from outside the Koberger home was consistent with being the source of DNA from the knife sheath. But like I said, it's partial. So I don't feel that that is something that is case closed. Simple as. It can't be. There's got to be more to this than that. The police then monitored Koberger outside his parents' home, and they were worried about the way that he was acting. And when you think about this from an observational perspective, and the investigators checking out somebody they now think has a car that matches the crime scene, they've got phone data that means that he's at least frequented the area. There's that relationship with Instagram and him following the girls, visiting the place that they work. And then they're watching him multiple times, wearing surgical gloves and putting bin bags inside of the neighbor's bins as opposed to in the bins according to his own home and his parents' home. So at this point, they're retrieving that because they're thinking, why is this guy putting all of this rubbish in bins that don't belong to the family? And they actually sent that to the Idaho State Lab for testing. Authorities were also really concerned about his behavior around his car. They said that he had cleaned his car inside and out, not missing an inch. Now, I have therefore needed to figure out whether this is to do with him ultimately wanting to get rid of any forensic evidence or whether there is something else. And I genuinely feel, reading about him, researching him, that this guy is OCD, that he has obsessive compulsive disorder. And I believe that the reason that he was going ahead and cleaning like he was cleaning is because it is part of his makeup and personality trait. I am not therefore saying that he is not responsible, by the way, for the murders. I'm just saying that I think that being caught with gloves on, doing weird things with rubbish, it is very resonant of somebody who has this particular issue. We get to the 30th of December 2022. At this point, he's taken into custody by an FBI SWAT team and also Pennsylvania State Police. This happens at his parents' home in Monroe County, Pennsylvania. When they arrest him, the police actually found Koberger in the kitchen. He was dressed in shirts and shorts. He was wearing gloves and he was putting trash into separate Ziploc bags, which sounds weird. But again, if you have OCD, and I know that some of you do, a lot of you have shared your own issues with OCD, you get it. I'm not saying, by the way, that he's not guilty. I'm not saying that he isn't absolutely the person that should be brought in for this. I'm just saying we have to analyze what this evidence is. And he's putting the trash into separate Ziploc bags. That would preserve things to some degree, not actually help them just become invisible in the long term. So it suggests to me somebody who's got this obsessive nature. They also search his home and they actually find a knife, a pistol, and also a black mask which covered the mouth and nose. And obviously then you think back to the original crime and the housemate seeing somebody walking out of the home with half of their face covered. They also found ID cards inside a glove, inside a box. So they feel that they're finding some really incriminating evidence here. Now, at this point, Coburg is detained without bond at the Monroe County Correctional Facility in Stroudsburg, Pennsylvania. He was appointed a public defender, Jason Labar. Jason Labar actually spoke to CNN and said that his client was shocked by the accusations against him. One would imagine you would be, particularly when you think about the gravity of these charges. Four murders of victims who did absolutely nothing to Coburg, if he's the actual assailant, and have lost their lives in the most brutal of way. Now, on the 3rd of January 2023, Coburg actually agreed to be extradited. He waived his right to an extradition hearing. He was obviously complying with everything. Labar, his attorney, said he's willing to waive because he's looking forward to being exonerated. Those were his words. Now, some people have said, well, he didn't say he was innocent. You know, he could have said, I'm innocent. But the words exonerated, I would say, were used, because what that ultimately says is, I'm going to be exonerated on the weight of the evidence because I am, in fact, innocent. I think playing with those words and suggesting that he didn't use the word innocent doesn't then make him seem more guilty. I think exonerated means that you'll just be across the table, thrown out because you know you have done nothing wrong. So on the 4th of January, he gets flown to Pullman. He's then driven to the Latar County Jail in Moscow, and understandably, he's held without bail. And when you think about the charges that are against him, understandably, he should not get bail. On the 5th of January, he makes his first appearance in the Latar County Courthouse. At this point, he is charged with four counts of first-degree murder and one count of burglary for breaking into a home with the intent to commit a felony. So the most serious of serious charges that anyone can face. At this point, he was given a new public defender, somebody called Ann Taylor. We get to the 17th of May 2023. The Latar County District Court announced that Coburg was indicted by a grand jury on five charges, the four counts of first-degree murder and one burglary. Now, when it comes down to the grand jury indicting him, all they need to do is hear that the prosecution feel that they have a sound case and be convinced by what the prosecution are saying. It doesn't mean ultimately that the jury have heard it and gone, oh, this guy's banged to rights, he's definitely guilty, throw the book at him. It just means they feel they have enough information that should it go before a jury, it will likely result in a case feeling that it should have been heard, even if that case eventually gets found innocent. So this is where they're at that point. This allows, of course, prosecutors to bypass the previously scheduled hearing for the 26th of June 2023. This is where the two surviving roommates of the victims may have been cross-examined at that point. Now, Coburg at this point refused to enter a plea. His attorney said he was standing silent on the charges. So at this point, the judge entered a not guilty plea for him. Coburg also waived his right to a speedy trial. So now we get to the 26th of June, 2023. At this point, the Latar County Prosecutor's Office said that they were going to seek the death penalty. They said that the aggravating circumstances of the first degree murder charges were so serious that death penalty was required. Coburg is currently being held in the Latar County Jail and has, as I said, been denied bond. Now, of course, Coburg's defense are saying this is all BS. This is so circumstantial that we should not be getting to a place where he has to appear in court full stop. They are saying, first of all, that Coburg was actually driving outside of Moscow on the night of the murders. They say that he went for a hike and a run. He went to go and look at the moon and the stars. Have a lovely time outside, looking at the moon and the stars. Looking at the way the world was around him, taking in the environment. Now, I'm thinking it's a weird time to do that, but look, everyone's different. I have weird kids who often go out to watch sunrises. So they literally get up at stupid o'clock, drive somewhere to watch a sunrise. I can do that literally from my bed. Just open the curtains and I watch it. But you know what? I don't, because I'm asleep. Because life's too short to constantly be waking up on a weekend doing those things. But my kids do it. So I get it. Also, my youngest son regularly goes for hikes and runs just as the sun is coming up. So I know that this is not completely atypical behavior. What I will say is on a holiday goes with a friend of his, but nonetheless, people do it all the time. But this is the argument that he wasn't even in the area, that he's out of the area when allegedly these killings are taking place. Now, the defense are allegedly going to try to corroborate this by using Koberger's phone data. Now, if that comes across and is true, obviously that will turn this on its head. But it could just be that they're hoping people will buy into that as a jury when they try the case. And evidently, the fact that his phone went off for that period of time, I would imagine the prosecution will say, no, this is a guy who just forensically knew, turn the phone off so that you cannot connect with a mast. Therefore, no one will know that you were at the victim's home during this period of time. Now, there have been some big issues so far with this case. There have been complaints about the evidence. So Koberger's lead attorney, Ann Taylor, she has said, first of all, she wants any upcoming hearings made public. And she said that the Latah County prosecutors have not provided a full video that allegedly shows Koberger's vehicle by the victim's house. Now, that's going to be really important. You know, when you're doing disclosure and you're working on a case, you need to know what the evidence is. In America, they're really good at this on the whole. You know, you get to see the evidence that the prosecution are putting out because it's helpful to your case as a defense, and rightly so. You want innocent people to be found innocent. You want guilty people to be found guilty. We don't have that in the UK. It's not quite as full the disclosure, which I think is a big problem with our justice system here. But in America, it works effectively. So this attorney has actually said, this is the video they say places this car near the residence. We've received little tiny pieces of that, and we think Brian's right to a fair trial means that the public needs to know that they've withheld the audio from a great portion of that, and it starts a long time before the little clip that we received. So they've accused prosecutors of keeping the defense in a vacuum to try to control the narrative. Now, the judge has actually ruled that the upcoming hearing will be closed in spite of them asking for it to be open. On the 7th of June 2024, this is following a closed door hearing, the judge, who's called Judge John Judge, like, did he just get born to always be that? He's granted the defense access under seal to the results of the investigative genetic genealogy testing, which used a touch sample from the knife sheath left at the crime scene. So that's gone ahead so that they can have information there. And the order actually said any further dissemination of the materials or information contained within the materials must first be approved by the court after showing by the defense as to why such an individual needs the information for preparation of the defense. Now, you can understand the defense want that information. It's as simple as that. They want to see what kind of connection they have DNA-wise to their client. Now, so far, the defense's mitigation expert, who's gone ahead and created her own family tree for the case, hasn't had any access to any of the information, but she is being allowed to continue her own investigation, and that includes contacting Koberger's immediate family members because obviously she can get samples from them. Now, the judge had scheduled a hearing for the 27th of June 2024 to look at the schedule for the case, including trial dates. And one of the things that's come from all of this is that the judge has granted Brian Koberger's request to have his trial moved out of Latah County. This is obviously where he's been accused of killing the four college students. And the reason for that is they don't believe necessarily he will have the safest or fairest trial if it's heard there. So Judge John Judge's order that had been unsealed very recently has moved the trial to an unspecified new location, they think possibly in Ada County. And the reason for that is they feel that just this massive media coverage could taint the local jury in and around Moscow where the attack took place. To be fair, let's be clear, I know about this case, you know about this case, we're obsessed with this case. So pretty much any jury who's had access to the internet in the last couple of years is going to have heard about this case. Whether you're on TikTok, Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, you're going to have heard about this case. But I suppose, arguably, moving it from a place where there is so many connected feelings, where people know each other, where people have been personally affected by this, it would be hard to find a jury who aren't potentially, shall we say, a little bit biased. They want whoever has carried out this attack to go down. And remember, it's a death sentence case, so it is absolutely imperative that they try it as fairly as possible. Ada County actually has a larger courthouse as well, and bear in mind, we're going to want to know exactly what is happening. So a lot of members of the public are going to go and are going to listen to how this plays out. I only have this much information. I will absolutely do a follow-up when I find out what happens in this case. I will follow the trial. I would love to know your thoughts. Right now, The question is, do you believe this case is sturdy enough? Do you believe the prosecution have enough to actually show a jury that Brian Koberger is indeed guilty of first-degree murder of four individuals? Or do you fear that they have decided to piece this case together based on information and evidence that may be destabilized by the defense? Do you feel that Brian Koberger is remaining quiet because he doesn't want to give anybody any information that could be used against him and he wants to save that for the court? Do you believe that he is guilty, or do you feel unsure? Do you feel right now the benchmark of reasonable doubt existing is there? It could be that the prosecution have got some really powerful evidence up their sleeve that they are going to bring forward. I think it will be interesting when this case gets to court to see cross-examination of the other members who were in the house, who didn't call the authorities very early on when they knew that things were going wrong in that house. It will be intriguing to actually see how they describe that and why they did the things that they did and how that comes across under cross-examination. And ultimately, what we want, all of us, is that the person responsible for the brutal destruction of four absolutely incredible young people who were going to make a difference in this world, we want that person tried at the highest level and given the strongest sentence. It's as simple as that. Every single one of us feels the same. That's it for Bang to Rights today. Join me for the next episode. See you then. Be safe.
Hi, I'm Kristen Bell, and if you know my husband Dax, then you also know he loves shopping for a car. Selling a car? Not so much.
We're really doing this, huh?
Thankfully, Carvana makes it easy. Answer a few questions, put in your VIN or license, and done. We sold ours in minutes this morning, and they'll come pick it up and pay us this afternoon.
Bye-bye, Truckee.
Of course, we kept the favorite.
Hello, other Truckee.
Sell your car with Carvana today. Terms and conditions apply.